Welcome to International Edition. I'm Ira Melvin. I'm in Washington. Coming up on today's program, the U.S. president moves from Saudi Arabia to London. We check in with VOA's Luis Ramirez in the British capital. Today is Earth Day. The Paris Agreement on the environment will begin gaining the participation it needs from governments around the world. You'll hear from one of those who guides the organization behind Earth Day.
What's happening is we're really building a movement that's bringing in new people every day. And I think the way we've accomplished our goals is to educate and engage key constituencies.
And we take a closer look at the death of an American musical icon, all on today's International Edition. U.S. President Barack Obama is in London now for talks with the British Prime Minister David Cameron on countering terrorism, the refugee crisis in Europe, and the global economy. The U.S. president arrived in the British capital after attending the Gulf Cooperation Council summit in Saudi Arabia, where he said the U.S. and the Gulf state leaders remain united in efforts to destroy Islamic State and stabilize the conflict-ridden Middle East region.
We remain united in our fight to destroy ISIL, or Daesh, which is a threat to all of us. And the United States will help our GCC partners ensure that their special operations forces are interoperable, and GCC nations will continue to increase their contributions to the fight against ISIL and the coalition that we've formed. We'll continue to support Iraq as it liberates and stabilizes towns and cities from ISIL control, and will remain leading donors of humanitarian aid to the peoples of Syria and Iraq who have suffered so much.
Well, as we mentioned, Mr. Obama is now in London, where we pick up the story with VOA's Luis Ramirez, who joins us live from the VOA London Bureau. Luis, what's on the president's schedule?
Well, Ira, that conversation that you just talked about the Islamic State, the efforts against that militant group, continues right here in London. That certainly will be at the top of the agenda when the president meets with Prime Minister David Cameron at 10 Downing Street later Friday. But first, he's sitting down for lunch with Queen Elizabeth, who celebrated her birthday on Thursday. The big topic, though, is that President Obama has dived right into a very contentious debate in the UK, and that is over whether Britain should remain in the European Union. British voters will go to the polls in a referendum on June 23rd. They will decide whether the UK should stay in the EU or get out. The president has certainly stoked some pretty sharp criticism. He had a column published in the Telegraph newspaper just moments after Air Force One touched down at an airport just outside London. A lot of criticism when he said that the UK would be stronger in the EU, and he said those words are coming from a friend. Certainly no friendly remarks from those who favor an exit from the European Union.
Yeah, they're not being demure about their words, too, are they?
Well, you know, we had some very strong words from the usual suspects, Nigel Farage, who heads a far-right anti-immigrant party, said the president, the U.S. leader, should, in his words, butt out. Now, other criticism came from London's mayor, who is certainly considered pro-U.S. We're talking about Boris Johnson. He was born in New York, is very much a friend of the United States, but said that on this issue, the United States should not be preaching to British voters what it would not practice at home. What he's referring to is he frequently says that no leader in Washington would ever accept having Canada or Mexico, which are partners of the United States in the North American Free Trade Agreement, no U.S. leader would ever allow those countries to impose their laws, regulations, taxes on U.S. soil.
And you mentioned that the president will be sitting down to a meal with the Queen, who turned 90 yesterday, but then he goes and meets with the younger royals, eh?
That lunch is happening just as we speak. Moments ago, the president and the first lady arrived aboard a helicopter at Windsor Castle. Were being driven by Prince Philip and the Queen, and then sitting down to lunch. After that, after a nice, cordial conversation with the monarch, they go to 10 Downing and meet with, or the president, I should say, goes to 10 Downing and meets with Prime Minister Cameron. Then there's a joint press briefing right after that. The president is scheduled to stay in Britain through Saturday.
Luis Ramirez reporting live with us from the VOA Bureau in London. Thanks, Luis.
Thanks, Ira.
Well, let's move to U.S. presidential politics. The three U.S. Republican candidates and their surrogates are wooing party officials in an oceanside resort in Florida, trying to shape rules that could govern a contested nomination fight at their party's national convention in July. Donald Trump, he's the front runner. He campaigned Thursday in Pennsylvania, the site of one of Tuesday's primaries. His top aides were meeting with party officials, meanwhile, and Trump says the varying election rules from state to state work against him. Still, Trump is vowing to exceed the 1,237 simple majority delegate count needed to be the party's nominee in the general election in November, but don't expect him to show his presidential side just yet.
We have a job to do. I've got two leftovers. I have to finish that, okay? We have to. We have to. And we're doing so good. And we have to be tough for a little while. And I'll be, at some point, I'm going to be so presidential that you people will be so bored. And I'll come back as a presidential person. And instead of 10,000 people, I'll have about 150 people. And they'll say, but boy, he really looks presidential.
Now, that's Donald Trump. On the Democratic side, Senator Bernie Sanders campaigned in Pennsylvania Thursday, hoping for better results in Tuesday's contest, including Pennsylvania, after Hillary Clinton posted a convincing win in New York earlier this week. Well, it's time now to check in with International Edition social media guru Andrew Palshevsky. Mr. Guru, what's trending here? I guess the Prince story.
Right? Yeah, there are sometimes in the news stories that kind of supersede everything else, and we've been talking about U.S. politics, and yesterday was Queen Elizabeth's 90th birthday, two big stories, and then we get this news that Prince dies, and everything just focuses on to Prince. I mean, fans all over the world, a global impact with his music, and so social media all through yesterday into today, tributes for the late legend, and really that's the word that a lot of people are using, legend, using words like iconic, transcendent, transcended, genres, race, all of these different classifiers. So we're seeing tributes, for example, a lot of people sharing the song lyrics, and two that I really thought were apt were people saying, "Life is just a party and parties weren't meant to last," from Prince's 1999, and then, "Dearly yep. Beloved, we are gathered here today to get through this thing called life," from Let's Go Crazy. So we're seeing a lot of those two quotes on social media. Another thing I really liked, they said, "We've lost our king, our queen, and now our prince," referring to Michael Jackson, Whitney Houston, who have both passed, and now Prince. So a lot of sadness, but a lot of good memories, too. A lot of sharing of the music and favorite songs, favorite moments. People have seen him in concert, been lucky to see him perform.
Brought a lot of joy to a lot of people.
Absolutely. And, you know, around the world, I mean, we saw some monuments around the world kind of being lit up in purple in honor of Prince here in the U.S. Interestingly, Niagara Falls was lit up in purple, but it was supposed to be for the Queen's 90th birthday. But it just so happened that lighting it up in purple, a very, you know, royal color, also a tribute for Prince. And on iTunes, somebody tweeted out and said that the top 11 songs on iTunes here in the U.S. are all Prince songs. And in fact, out of the top 100, 59 of them are Prince songs. So it just goes to show how many people are flocking to buying his music online and sharing that music with their friends.
The reaction. Anything else coming up in the short time we have left here?
Well, the other story is Earth Day, but, you know, that, like I said, a big, what would have been a big story today around the world has kind of gotten bumped down as everybody still continues to mourn Prince.
And you can't see it right now, but Andrew is indeed wearing a purple shirt. Andrew Palshevsky, our social media guru here on the International Edition. Thanks, Andrew, once
Thank
again.
You.
This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
As
NASA continues its plans to send people to deep space destinations such as Mars, the effects of long-distance space travel on the human body needs to be better understood. A new study in the journal PLOS ONE finds that mice who had flown aboard the space shuttle Atlantis came back to Earth with early symptoms of liver disease. The mice at the center of the study orbited the Earth for 13 and a half days on the final space shuttle flight back in 2011. Researchers from the University of Colorado gathered and studied samples of their livers upon their return. Their study found that the little space travelers had symptoms of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, along with early signs of fibrosis, a mostly non-reversible condition that can lead to cirrhosis, which can be fatal. The researchers plan to examine the livers of mice who fly in space for longer periods of time to see if there are any compensatory mechanisms that might protect them. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Today is Earth Day. It all started in 1970 with thousands turned out to demonstrate support for environmental protection. This event has grown to a global event now by an organization called the Earth Day Network, and it's celebrated in almost 200 countries. We welcome to International Edition Susan Bash. She is Senior Vice President of Programs and Operations of that organization. Susan, today we're going to see something very different, the signing of a World Environmental Agreement. Can you explain?
Sure, Ira. Thanks for having me. So the first Earth Day started in 1970 in the United States when our rivers were on fire, the skies were black, there was a very visible pollution that everyone could see and feel and directly had an impact on their lives. And so 20 million Americans came out on the streets and they mobilized the first generation of environmental laws, which have been very successful not only in the United States but in countries around the world, addressing problems like water pollution and hazardous waste and air pollution. However, today we face a whole new generation of problems that are harder for people to understand in their daily lives, like climate change, although we're starting to see more of the impacts with the irregular weather patterns and some of the global tragedies that we've been experiencing. So I think people are starting to get the message. And so Earth Day has caught up with those problems, and we're now operating in over 190, as you said, close to 200 countries around the world, educating people and mobilizing them to address this new generation of environmental problems.
Now, tell me about what happens today, later on today, as far as the Paris agreements are concerned.
Sure. So Ban Ki-moon, the head of the United Nations, has invited countries from around the world to sign the agreement, which was negotiated last December in Paris, and it's the first really global treaty that comprehensively addresses climate change, and we're very excited to have all these countries coming from around the world to sign the agreement, and there's a process of ratification and depositing the agreement, so it'll take probably a few more months, hopefully not that much longer, before it actually comes into effect. But this is the beginning of the process of implementing the agreement, which was signed last December in Paris.
How has Earth Day contributed to reaching this level so far?
I think what's happening is we're really building a movement that's bringing in new people every day. And I think the way we've accomplished our goals is to educate and engage key constituencies. We have our grassroots. Are originally in schools, and to this day, we still work with educators across the world and school children, and they're really active today getting out the word about climate change and educating students. But we're also bringing in new constituencies and engaging them, educating people in connection with the voting process so they'll vote green, and also getting people out on the streets and getting them to connect with their elected leaders. So we've really focused on engaging people and getting their voices heard by the decision makers and influencers.
My family has just returned from a trip to China. From personal experience, the air in some of those cities is just awful. I understand that they are doing as much as they can, and they are set to sign this agreement. How much work places like China and India is there to be done, and how do you go about doing that on a worldwide basis?
Sure. So we have two programs, actually, in India and China, and we're very excited. Actually, my first Earth Day was in China, and I agree that the air pollution there is really extraordinary and of great concern to the people of China and the government of China. This year, we will be mobilizing 40 universities and students in those universities to get involved and learn about climate change and air pollution and to start engaging with their elected leaders on strategies to address those problems. We have one of the major campaigns that we're doing this year is our tree planting campaign, the Paris Climate Agreement. Many of the countries have committed to planting trees because not only do the trees absorb carbon, but if you prevent the chopping of trees, then you're also preventing the emissions of carbon. And this is a
That's Susan Bass. She is with the organization that has founded and continues to hold Earth Day. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondence, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support of Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day, wherever the news may be. Our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
This is International Edition from VOA. American pop icon Prince, known for hits like When Doves Cry, Purple Rain, Little Red Corvette, and I Want to Be Your Lover, has died at the age of 57. His publicist confirmed his death after reports that police were investigating a death at his home outside Minneapolis, Minnesota. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA's Soul Lounge host, Shauna Renee, about the life, the music, and the death of Prince.
A shock to all of us. I do believe that he was suffering from diabetes. There was a report that he admitted that he had been suffering from epilepsy some years ago. But again, at this moment, we don't know exactly what the cause of death is. We know that foul play has been ruled out, which will lead us to believe that it was natural causes.
His catalog goes all the way back to the 1970s.
Yes.
I remember his first album, his first hit, I Want to Be Your Lover,
mm-hmm.
in high school.
Mm-hmm.
We played the grooves off of that record, and he was a phenomenal guitar player. He was a phenomenal bass player, which mm-hmm. a lot of folks don't realize. He was a composer. He could tell you if the speaker stacks were out of phase. He was, to put it lightly, a genius, a musical genius, almost the personification of funk.
Oh, absolutely. And pop, because he had that, and R&B, because he had those elements as well, and rock, because we heard a lot of rock influence in some of his latter stuff. Now, I was introduced to Prince a little later on, during the Purple Rain phase. I had the album and played it over and over again. One of my favorite songs still to this day is When Doves Cry.
Why do we scream at each other?
Prince was always ahead of his time. He was always a very provocative artist in terms of the kinds of things that he sang about, the themes, but also, like you say, musically, he was not afraid to experiment with different sounds and textures and instruments. And I remember him sort of being the first artist that kind of brought sort of that electric sound into music, along with the more acoustic traditional sounds of the instruments that he played. And I think it's also very important, as we remember Prince, to not only remember him as a musical genius, but also to know that he was an activist. He was very, very active in terms of artists' rights. You may remember later on, I think it was sort of the 90s, when we couldn't call him Prince anymore.
Right, he became a symbol, a hieroglyph.
The artist formerly known as Prince. And this was because he was in a huge legal battle with Warner Brothers. And he was also a social activist and a civil rights activist. I mean, if you go back and listen to some of his songs, he was very much aware of what was going on in the U.S. He was also aware of some of the issues around the world, and those themes found their way into his songs as well. Another one of my all-time favorite songs is Sign of the Times. And if you listen to that song, you hear a man who was saying, listen to what is going on in inner city America. Be aware of what is happening and how this is affecting us all.
What do you think? Send us a tweet. You can send one to Shauna. She is at VOA Lady DJ or at VOA underscore music. Look for more of our coverage of the life and the death of Prince on our website, voanews.com.
That's going to wrap up our program for today. I'm Ira Melman, wishing you a fine day ahead, and thanks for joining us on International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The 2015 Country Reports on Human Rights Practices, issued by the State Department in mid-April, saw the continuation of a disturbing trend, that of tightening of restrictions on civil society and private citizens, particularly journalists and voices of the opposition. In every part of the world, we see an accelerating trend by both state and non-state actors to close the space for civil society, to stifle media and internet freedom, to marginalize opposition voices, and in the most extreme cases, to kill people or drive them from their homes, wrote Secretary of State John Kerry in the report's introduction. The report noted that a number of authoritarian governments attempted to stifle civil society and activists both through harassment, intimidation, detention, and restrictions on their ability to operate, as well as by implementing very broad counterterrorism or national security laws to control the freedom to assemble and to suppress dissent, and by increasing the bureaucratic obstacles non-governmental organizations had to navigate. Such governments stifle civil society because they fear public scrutiny. To justify their repressive actions, they present a variety of excuses. They may point out that civil society is not elected and is therefore not representative or accountable, that foreign NGOs undermine national sovereignty, or that regulating civil society is necessary to prevent financing of terrorism. However, such arguments become moot, according to the report, when one realizes that civil society does not have the power to force people into obeying their decisions, and that it is influential because it reflects a grassroots need within a community. The report notes also that terrorist groups like Daesh make efforts to drive off, shut down, or kill civil society activists as soon as they take control of a community. According to the report, terrorist groups take such action because local grassroots civil society organizations can sometimes stand up against violent extremists more effectively than a government security agency. In his remarks at the rollout of the publication, Secretary Kerry said, "The choice some governments offer between freedom and stability is thus a false one, for freedom is the foundation for lasting stability." Kerry concluded that the frequently grim examples detailed in this report strengthen our resolve to promote fundamental freedoms, to support human rights defenders, and to document and promote accountability for violations of human rights.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.